This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show, Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. Thank you for all of your ideas for the Big Ideas episode yesterday. Properly interested in that. I think we might do that again because we had so many. Right, coming up on today's show, it's the Times Radio Focus Group for January. We speak to a panel of swing voters, former Labour, former Tory voters, what they think about lockdown and the party leaders and when they think we might be back to normality. But first, it's Tuesday, so our columnist panel must be Daniel Finkel Stein and David Aronovich. I should point out that the feature before them, when I spoke to them on the radio, we were talking to someone about doing sex parties online, which might explain why the conversation kicked off like this. Daniel Finkelstein, good morning.
Good morning. I was reflecting that putting the news in the middle of a sex party that I attend sounds just like the sort of sex party I'd get invited to.
David Aronovich, nice to see you. Morning.
Yeah, me too. I was thinking that I kind of remember parties and I just about remember sex.
Well, either of you ever had anything bad happen to you on Zoom?
On Zoom?
Yeah. What's the worst thing that's happened to you on Zoom or other platforms are available? That's it just made me think that it'd be very easy if you're attending one of these virtual sex parties to, you know, for the dog to wander in or the doorbell to go or your work emails to suddenly ping.
It's funny you should say that, but I did hear an absolutely true story, and I mustn't kind of locate it at all, about a teacher who was giving instructions to his girl students, actually, on something like Zoom, and forgot when he went to take a leak, because he took his laptop with him, that actually, though he couldn't see them anymore, they could see him. And this got significantly... and this image apparently was captured instantaneously in the way that 17-year-olds have the capacity to do nowadays and shared with the entire class. And I was thinking how unfair and terrible that was, really, because there's nobody who doesn't pee and so on. So his mistake is simply to take... But immediately, people begin to suspect that you're some kind of weird sex pest who takes your computer with you to the loser. Anyway...
Are you beginning to regret having asked David that question, Matt?
No, I was just going to make point that if they were in a classroom and the teacher said, right, all come with me, and he'd taken all the students into the toilets, that would have been weird, which is essentially what he did. So I think the onus is probably on the teacher to have thought about that. Anyway, let's focus on what we're supposed to be talking about. And events in America, and we're sort of the picking over the wreckage of the riot in the Capitol last week. And it seems like there's a big debate going on in America right now, David, about the right way forward. Is it to come down hard on the rioters, but also Donald Trump, impeach him, remove him from office, punish everyone as hard as possible? Or is it to pursue a process of healing, that sort of terrible, slightly American phrase of bringing the country together. What do you think is the right way forward?
Well, I, one of the things I want to discuss is, because I'm very interested to hear what Danny's view about this is, because it's a genuine dilemma. On the one hand, you don't want to allow the precedent to be established that somebody like Donald Trump and other people around him could behave in this kind of a way, let alone the rioters in the Capitol, who are clearly illegal and will be punished. But we're talking about Trump or people close to him on the one hand. And on the other hand, it's pretty clear that Joe Biden needs to get on with an agenda which is very much about dealing with the biggest problems America's got and really doesn't want to be sidetracked. And this is a genuine dilemma. It's not a kind of false dilemma. Now, he might, and it's a dilemma even if it's the Congress which takes on Trump, because it takes up bandwidth and time which actually he wants to have available to him to deal with those other problems. I was wondering whether what Danny thought about this and whether there were any kind of equivalents in our political past where such a choice has had to be made.
Mm. Well, not so much here. I think this is the biggest problem that America faces. And so if Joe Biden were to deal with it, he wouldn't be facing away from it. He'd be facing into America's biggest problem. It's a version of what I call Ford's dilemma. So in 1974, Gerald Ford had a problem. It's slightly different. Constructed as to what to do with Richard Nixon. Did the United States, did America want its former president to end up in jail? I think the different, he determined not and gave Ford a pardon, and Ford gave Nixon a pardon. But I think the difference here is that this is an assault on America's liberal institutions. And sometimes the right way to fight a political battle, well, I suppose this would be a corresponding thing. It's a slightly different issue, but in 1979, when Margaret Thatcher stood on the door of number 10 Downing Street, she famously said, "Where there's discord, let us bring harmony." And she was much lampooned later because there was a lot of discord under her premiership. But the reason she said that is because there was discord when she took office. And there are two ways of dealing with discord. One is you conciliate the discord. And that had been what we'd been trying to do for 20 years. Something that I'd supported, my dad supported, my family supported, thought it was the right thing to do. The other way of dealing with it is you simply win the battle. You end the discord that way. I'm by nature a conciliator. And I was uncomfortable with what Margaret Thatcher did when she started doing it. But I think it brought more harmony than discord. It didn't eliminate discord, but it brought more harmony than discord, because winning the battle sometimes is the right way to fight it. So my view on this is that Joe Biden has to win this battle. And in this particular instance, I don't think healing is the right... I think the right way to heal is to complete the battle. I don't think conciliation is the right way of dealing with this particular problem.
Interesting, because I honestly expected you to go the other way. So you've actually surprised me.
Yeah.
No, well, he didn't even have to take you to the toilet. Is it partly because of the nature of Donald Trump's wrongdoing as being slightly distinct to the sort of Nixon one? Is that if the American political machine, the Constitution, doesn't act to protect itself, to make it clear to future presidents that you can't order riots on the Capitol, then it's clearing the way for maybe, yes, Joe Biden's successor to do the same thing, or even his next rival at the next election?
So I would have been in favour of conciliating when it came to, for instance, Donald Trump's tax affairs, right? I wouldn't have been in favour of pursuing him particularly in a kind of aggressive way. People have to keep the law, but I think there would have been a case for attempting to move on from that. This is of a wholly different order. You cannot allow the institutions of government to be subverted in that way in favour of overturning the election. And unfortunately, I don't think that this is something you can easily compromise with or allow to slide. There are some other things where, at the cost of a small amount of principle, and I give that example of tax, you can. But there are other instances where you can't, and I think this is one of them. Reluctantly, but I do think that.
So, what do you think the move should be? Is it remove him from office, impeach him? What would be your preferred route, Danny?
Well, I think we're going to run out of time for either impeachment, and Pence isn't going to do Section 25. So then there's a legal question as to whether you can impeach someone who's left office. I'd certainly be in favour of exploring that, because it would prevent him from running for office again. And I think it's that dangerous, and I think that that would be a merited act. But it may not be. But, you know, constitutional scholars do differ over whether or not, and they, on balance, I think it probably isn't possible, in fact, to do that. So then he is subject to legal penalty if he's committed legal offences. Again, it's possible that his supporters have, but he hasn't. But I think you examine what you can.
Well, what about you, David? What's your preferred course of action?
I was listening to Alan Dershowitz, who's that sort of strange combination of Jonathan Sumption and Piers Morgan in the American system, talking this morning about how, if you examine Trump's speech, then it amounted to before the occupation of the Capitol. It didn't amount to an incitement, because it was no more or less than lots of people would tend to say rhetorically. To which one's response was immediately, well, he's the president of the United States, and surely there's a kind of extra standard. But the question about whether or not that standard was either legal or reached to the levels of impeachment would be an interesting question. But I actually agree with Danny very much. It seems to me that a delayed impeachment, in other words, the impeachment going ahead, because pour encourager les autres after the and also to disqualify him, after the case would be good. The only problem is, it looks very unlikely they'd get the two-thirds majority in the Senate they would need. They get a majority, probably, but not a two-thirds majority. And that message that that then sends out is problematic in itself. But on the other hand, like Danny, I don't really see an alternative to it, because you've got to say, this up with this, we will not put. We cannot put up with this.
Yeah, you do.
Well, let's turn our attention to someone who's come out of the last few days rather better. The actor and, of course, former California governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Let's take a listen to him comparing the US Capitol riots to Nazi Germany.
Now, I grew up in Austria. I'm very aware of Kristallnacht, or the Night of Broken Glass. It was a night of rampage against the Jews carried out in 1938 by the Nazi equivalent of the Proud Boys. Wednesday was the Day of Broken Glass right here in the United States. They did not just break down the doors of the building that housed the American democracy. They trampled the very principles on which our country was founded.
I mean, it was quite a moment, that, Danny. Arnold Schwarzenegger, maybe because of where he's from, able to spell out what others have been perhaps thinking?
I didn't have the same problem that some other Jews did have with the use of the Kristallnacht parallel. My grandfather, actually, funny enough, that was one of the people who collected all the witness statements for Kristallnacht as part, and that became then part of both the Eichmann and Nuremberg trials. And I've sort of studied this quite a bit. And although obviously it's not the equivalent, it's the purpose of learning all these historical lessons, the never again speeches, the discussion of the way that Nazi parties and fascist parties arise, is so that we'll recognise this kind of action when we see it. And if we don't, then there's no point in all the, you know, then it's mere historical commemoration. And I think that would in some ways be an insult to the lessons of Kristallnacht. So I didn't have a, it's not equivalent, but I didn't have a problem with him using that parallel.
What about you, David? What did you make of it?
Yeah, I think that, sorry to be really boring here, but I think that's absolutely right. What Schwarzenegger was saying is, here's a process whereby fairly ordinary people can gradually be seduced into becoming essentially fascists and behaving in a fascistic way. And I lived with the immediate consequences of that, because the men of my father's generation were the people who did that and who spent their time being incredibly guilty about it. And that guilt came out in the way in which people like myself and my mother were treated. It was both very personal and very political. And it seemed to me that that was essentially true. That's exactly true. It's not true that some kind of strange other form of human being becomes a Nazi or a fascist, or becomes the kind of people who tolerate that kind of thing. The problem is that it's people like us who can become that. And so you need to notice when that process is underway, and you need to stop it. And that was Schwarzenegger's point, and it seemed to me entirely apropos.
Yeah, it was quite a moment, and we'll talk more about that with Henry Zeffman in about an hour or so. Let's come closer to home and talk about Keir Starmer. We'll hear what the focus group have got to say about him in about half an hour's time. He seems to once again be getting himself into some contortions over the EU and Brexit and all of that. David, what do you think is going on there?
Well, he had a simple, I suppose he feels he has a simple problem, which is that he wants to conciliate the voters. He wants not to alienate the Remain voters, who by and large he's already got, but he wants to try and bring back into the camp people who might have voted Leave. And he wants to stop the EU being an issue, a divisive issue for Labour at the next election, where essentially what he wants to be able to do is to go into the next election saying, I'm not talking about rejoining the EU, I'm not talking about being divisive, I'm talking about getting a better set of relationships with the EU than the Conservatives would get you, but the other thing is off the table. But there is a long-term problem with it, and it's really straightforward, which is that the logic of the size of the EU, our trade relationships with the EU, our closeness to the EU, is that sooner or later the question of a much closer relationship with the EU will rise again. And if the Labour Party is not the party that deals with that and that suggests it and that formulates a potential policy to move in that direction, then somebody else has got to be. And that is going to, and the other problem is the generational problem. Quite a lot of us think that younger people today will in 5 to 10 years' time look again at how Europeans move around the European continent, how that European business moves around the European continent, and ask themselves the question, why on earth are we not able to do these things? It's just a logical thing. Now, that's not a prediction with a huge force behind it. That's just an intuition that people like me and I think quite a lot of other people have.
Danny, is there a risk with Keir Starmer? You know, to have these slight contortions he gets into. He's overly concerned, perhaps, that he was the architect of Labour's Remain policy, wanting a second referendum. So then worrying about that and people thinking he's a big Remainer, he sort of tries to go too far the other way. I mean, to some extent, if you look quite a lot, people don't know, and we'll hear from the focus group in a moment. People don't have very much of a pressure of him at all. Is he fretting about things that don't matter for the benefit of us who pick over the tiny the tea leaves of all these things? He just needs to make a bigger impression with the public on big issues.
He's certainly, if he's worried about the impression that his previous career in the shadow cabinet has made, then that would be worrying about nothing, because without any question, people don't know about that. My question is whether or not he's making a correct strategic decision. It is the obvious strategic play to try to win back the red wall seats and to aim your strategy around the red wall seats. And, you know, Labour was, for instance, just last night in the House of Lords voting with a kind of, you know, the more security-minded proposals of the government against the wishes of some more liberal people, against Shami Chakrabarti's amendments and things like that, and I think that they that is a choice that is questionable. Not I'm talking here in policy terms. I'm talking here strategically. It seems to me that the future of the Labour Party almost certainly lies with Liberal Britain. If you think that Tony Blair's correct in thinking that there's an open versus closed battle that's going to emerge, then Labour's future lies with open and trying to trap the Conservative Party with closed. Now, I'm only too pleased if they don't do that, because it poses an acute dilemma for someone like me, who's an open, who would describe myself as a sort of open-orientated Conservative. And that is indeed what he's decided to do, go down the route of propitiating the red wall seats, move towards neutralising Brexit. I can see the immediate appeal of that, because there are low-hanging fruit, there's red wall seats, but I'm not sure strategically it's the correct decision for Labour.
So if Keir Starmer picked up the phone to you, David, and said, what do you think I should be doing? You know, need to step up a gear, it's 9 months into the job now. What would be your advice to him?
I think I would have said the question of our long-term relationship with Europe is not going to go away. And this issue of what that relationship would be is going to return. And in general, Labour's view is going to be that we should have close relationships with with the European Union. And what that leads to, time will tell. Time might tell. Now, of course, that opens him up to all kinds of attacks from Brexiteers and so on. The most damaging of which is, you're going to take us through all this again. But I think actually those can be met. And I'm slightly worried that there is a kind of tone of cack-handed populism entering into some of Labour's responses to a whole series of things at the moment, when actually it can afford to be, as Danny says, a little bit more measured, a little bit more strategic, and lay out its stall mostly in the area of competence rather than in winning back specific sections of voters who may not even actually quite exist in the same way by the time we get to 2024.
That was Danny Finkelstein and David Ivanovich there. And of course, you can read them both on the Times website, or pick up a copy of the paper, subscribe, get yourself a digital subscription to the Times. So just go to thetimes.co.uk, click on any story, sign up, and you get your first month for free, which is a bit of a boosty bonus. Up next is that Times Radio Focus Group.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Shawley. Now, as promised, it's time for the Times Radio Focus Group for January. As ever, I'm joined by James Johnson, who used to run polling for Number 10 when Theresa May was in charge. He's working with polling firm Kext CNC to bring us the focus group. Morning, James.
Good morning.
As ever, let's start with the get out clause, or at least the explanation, because people will say focus groups, that what's the point of them? They're not as good as opinion polls. Explain to us the value of focus groups.
Yeah, absolutely. So unlike a poll, which is intended to be representative with around, you know, 1,000, 2,000 people, focus group is much smaller. It's 6, 7, 8 people. So it's not intended to sum up what the public think about a given thing. That's what we use polling for. What focus groups are there for is a much more in-depth discussion where you can talk with voters and really understand what's behind those headline numbers in some of the polls. It also helps political parties test messages, and really, just as I say, just get into that further depth. So that's the big caveat, really. We're not saying this is what the British public think. We're saying this is what a cross-section do. And here we're talking to a group of English swing voters. They're from London, Manchester and Walsall. Half of them voted Labour in 2019, half of them voted Conservative, and they're now saying they're undecided how they would vote if there was an election tomorrow.
Thank you, as ever, James, for that explanation. And you're right, with things like testing messaging and that sort of thing, if a political party says, oh, we were thinking of using this slogan, they put it to a focus group. If the group laugh, you're not going to get that, or look baffled. You're not going to get that necessarily if you do it in polling. So actually, you know, gaining that human reaction is really important. So let's kick off then with the question that you always start with, just to get a sense of where the group is and their general views on politics. The big question: how is the government doing?
Well, doing terrible. They keep on changing their mind at the last minute, which benefits no one. I think they've handled it quite badly, and I think they pander to the public more than to their advice. I think they're quite a populist government.
I think it could be doing a lot better. I mean, I wouldn't want to be in their kind of shoes at the moment with what they've got to deal with. I don't agree with a lot of things they've done. I believe they should have done it a lot sooner and a lot harder restrictions straight away from the beginning, instead of this having to go in and out of lockdown constantly.
In terms of the government, I've spent much of my life criticising the Conservative Party, but I think this is a very hard situation we're in at the moment, so I've tried to not play any kind of party politics with that.
I think they're doing all right, but they could do a lot better. I never really agreed with a tier system that they brought into place because I didn't really understand how they were deciding what areas to put in what tier. Like when they put Manchester into tier 3 and most places down south in tier 2 when Manchester's high rating wasn't as bad.
I don't think they're doing a bad job. I think it's probably unprecedented times where they never really planned for it, but also at the same time they probably could have acted a bit faster and a bit harder in the beginning.
Well, there we are. That was the focus group's views on how the government's doing. James, a more forgiving group than we've seen in previous months. We probably shouldn't read too much into that. They might just be forgiving people rather than thinking there's necessarily been a shift in overall public opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got to put this in the context of the previous groups. However, there is a trend there that we have seen throughout the last 6 months or so, which is people saying, well, actually, the pandemic could have happened under any government. And that leads them to giving a bit of the benefit of the doubt for some of the decisions made. They talk about not envying the position of Boris Johnson. They say, you know, you can't judge them too harshly on this. There's a couple of things behind that, as well. I think the move away from the tier system in the last month might have helped. You heard one gentleman there talking about, you know, when Manchester was moved into tier 3, we know from our other focus groups that was seen as complicated and confusing. So I think national lockdown may have helped with some of that sense. And also, interestingly, throughout this, you know, when we started the focus group and asked them, you know, what they'd heard in the news and so on, the reference to the pandemic isn't actually front of mind. And I've heard a few people talk about that who also do market and public research. You know, actually, people sort of increasingly sort of seeing the pandemic as the norm rather than something that's, you know, right there and is viewed as a political subject in their minds.
Yes, yeah, so right at the very beginning, even before you ask that question, just get people to go around, introduce themselves. What do they do for a living? And what news have they noticed? And it was Donald Trump, Americans going crazy, Trump impeached, and then a few others did mention coronavirus. So, yeah, it's not sort of right at the forefront of mind. We'll talk more about lockdown and the handling of all that and the understanding of all that. But let's focus on the politics right now and the two party leaders and the two main party leaders and how they're viewed. Let's kick off with how the group view Boris Johnson.
Boris Johnson has made many, many U-turns during this whole pandemic. But I think it's better for him to make a U-turn than realise when he's wrong and correct it. So he's kind of swallowed his pride, which it would be good if he got it right in the first place. But it's such a hard situation. He's trying to balance many different things at the same time. So he has made some blunders. Yes, he has. But he's done some good things as well. So I would be 50-50 in terms of Boris Johnson.
I think he's trying to do as good as he can. I don't really would not want to be in his shoes, but he has made a few mistakes or he should have done things a bit sooner. But in the end, I think he's just like us. He's getting the information. He's trying to do what he can.
I think he's a bit indecisive and I don't think he's very good at getting a point across to the average working man.
His last-minute decisions, if you could stop doing that and stop making plans and then packing them off when it's most important. If he stopped doing that, be fine. Otherwise, he's doing quite a good job considering what he has to put up with.
I'll be honest, I quite like Boris. He's always, I've always found him to be quite honest and stuff. And like we just see his actions and what he does. But as people have said, it's unprecedented times and he's sort of having to go with the flow. Yeah, okay, he's made some bad decisions in some, but he has quickly U-turned them, and he's I think he's always tried to put the best of the country first, but I don't think he's always got it right first or second time.
I think he's doing the best that he can do, like in the situation that he's in. Like, I don't think we could be in better hands facing this pandemic, if I'm completely honest.
I think he's doing okay. It's such a fluid situation. It's changing on a weekly stroke daily basis, so I think he's doing as best he can. You can't go looking back on with hindsight. Hindsight's a wonderful thing, but you've got to deal with the here and now.
And in general, over the last year, have your guys' views of Boris got better or got worse?
Same.
Yeah, I'd say the same.
I'd say better.
I'd say the same.
I'd say the same.
I'd say probably the same because I'd like him to begin with.
A bit better, actually, yeah.
There we are. James Johnson, there will be people screaming at the radio right now at the suggestion that we couldn't be in better hands. I mean, this group is a good counterpoint to anyone who's ever gone on to Twitter to see how people are viewing the Prime Minister. The other thing that really stuck out for me is the public's view of U-turns being very different to that portrayed in the media sometimes. That actually people don't mind U-turns. They'd rather he got the decision right in the first place. But if he's recognised that something isn't working, they don't mind him changing his mind, which quite often the media portrayal of U-turns is one of weakness. But the public can be quite forgiving about that too.
Yes, and I think what we see there is, you know, Boris's reputation, you're being sort of protected in some sense by that same thing we identified in the first clip, you know, this sort of sense that, you know, the government is in a very difficult situation and Boris Johnson is doing a good as job as he can. As you say, very different from sort of the sense you might get from reading Twitter. And as you also heard there, you know, people saying that Boris Johnson improved in the last year. The U-turns thing, I think you're right. You know, these guys did view that as a positive. The danger point, though, for Boris Johnson, and what we've heard in other groups as well as here, is that that has sort of taken away some of those brand strengths that he had at the last election, which were this sense that he had grip and that he was decisive. Although they're sort of, you know, they see the positive side of a U-turn, that sort of sense that things are changing and churning and there's indecision and there's a lack of clarity, there's a sort of, you know, sometimes pandering to others, that has sort of weakened slightly Boris Johnson's sort of brand for strength. Now, there are still some positives in there about Boris's brand. You heard people there talking about him, you know, being honest, and I think somebody else said later in the group, you know, he's like us. Again, that may well get some people shouting at the radio, but you can just see that sort of slight shift in the brand on the U-turns, and I think that matters for Boris Johnson in the long term.
Okay, let's turn to the other side of the coin there. That's what they thought about Boris Johnson. Now let's hear what they think about the Labour leader, Keir Starmer.
I mean, I don't know much about him. He's like that money guy. I don't know if it is the money guy, then I don't really agree with a lot of the things he does.
He's the Labour opposition Prime Minister.
Yeah. Well, I don't really know much about it, to be honest. I've heard of his name, but I tend not to read a lot recently in the news because it's too depressing.
From what I've seen of what he's done so far, I don't think he's doing great. Especially from what my dad was telling me before, because he's much more of a Labour fan, but I think he's going towards the other way now.
As an ex-lawyer that he is, he's just consistently criticising, trying to use the benefit of hindsight. There's no constructivity with them, with any of them, from the top down, and he is just there to criticise.
I'll be honest, I'm not too fond of the Labour Party, especially, but at the end of the day, he can't be any worse than the ex-Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn. The only way he could be worse is if he's an anti-Semite as well, but hopefully he's not.
Yeah, as opposition leader, because this pandemic is it doesn't matter which government's in, I think I see him basically just in the background speaking occasionally, so I haven't paid him much attention at all.
Well, it's generally the role of the leader of the opposition to put pressure on the government and hold them to account. But I think in a crisis like this, it's not good to play politics. I think when Keir Starmer was interviewed after the lockdown was announced, he did say, you know, I don't want to quarrel with the government at this time. So I think they need to support the government where they can. So, yeah, I mean, opposition leaders are always going to criticise the government, but I think he's done okay. He's not gone too overboard with it, but if he wasn't criticising at all, he wouldn't be doing his job as a Labour leader.
It's not a party political thing, this is a pandemic. He should be supporting Johnson to the hilt.
Shouldn't be scoring points off at times like these. They should be pulling together for the good of the country. He's not pulling together for the good of the country. He's picking over all of the decisions that Boris and the government are doing, and any ones that have got wrong or any ones that they've slightly snuffed up or something, he's just ripping them apart afterwards, which there's no point in doing that. It's not helpful, and it just leaves a bad taste in your mouth.
I do agree. He should be very supportive at the moment because the whole country, well, the whole world's going through a pandemic. And everyone needs to stick together.
Or coming back with a better solution.
Well, there we are. That's what our Times Radio focus group thought about Keir Starmer. James Johnson, the good that Team Labour could take out of that is that people do still see him as an improvement on Jeremy Corbyn. So he's not the negative that Jeremy Corbyn clearly was for them on the Labour Party, but he's not really landed a positive. Is it a problem for the Leader of the Opposition that 9 months in, he doesn't seem to have made an impact, and, you know, a randomly selected group of 7 or 8 people on the focus group, none of them really knew very much about him or had formed sort of any positive view at all. Is that a problem?
Yeah, I think there is a risk there for Keir Starmer. We've talked about this before, you know, this sort of sense of lying low and, you know, being perhaps quite cautious has actually potentially put Keir Starmer in the sort of worst of both worlds, where some think he's taking political advantage and doing too much, and others actually think he's absent and not doing much at all. And I think what was interesting there is that the people who didn't know him, as they heard the other respondents talking about the playing politics and the scoring points attack, they then started repeating those things themselves, including the lady who didn't even know who Keir Starmer was. So, you know, there's a real risk for Keir Starmer there that if he doesn't sort of land a punch and sort of, you know, really sort of, you know, give a clear sense of who he is to these voters, they may well fill in the blanks for him. Now, as you say, it's not all bad. And, you know, even compared to Ed Miliband, let alone Corbyn, you know, there's not this sort of default negative view that's really set in. But there is a real danger here. And I think the learning point from this is that, you know, political leader has to define themselves early or they'll risk being defined by the public.
And if you get a reputation for being sort of a wishy-washy sort of carping from the sidelines, you need to do something quite bold then to shake that off and create a new impression.
Yeah, and to be clear, you know, I think that you could listen to those people and say, well, you know, Keir Starmer should only go and back the government now. I don't think that's right. I think that actually, you know, any opposition would be accused of that. I think what Keir Starmer needs to do is try and get off of this fence of trying to do both, and then he may well be able to land some punches, not only on Boris Johnson, but crucially, getting a sense of who he is out there to these voters before it's too late.
OK, let's move on to, you asked them how they would vote now. And this was really interesting because it's like you said, they were split 50-50, half voted Labour last time, half voted Tory. Let's take a listen to what they said. If you asked them if they changed their mind about how they might vote now.
I have. I used to be Labour all the time. Always used to be Labour. Mainly just because I liked what they said and that sounded right. But as soon as Boris was kind of, you know, getting up there to be elected, I was kind of like, I actually liked him because he seemed like a normal human being. When a lot of, you know, people that go for that role don't seem like they have that sympathy. They don't seem like they have, you know, they kind of know what a standard human being would be. They don't know the working class. I definitely would go for Conservative now, just purely because I actually like Boris. I think he's doing a good job.
I wouldn't say I've completely changed my mind, but I'd say if there was another general election now, I'd have to have a good think about it because I'm unsure now. Before, I voted Labour, but now I think I'm unsure, so I don't know. To do with the new guy they've got in Labour as well, I don't think they're as strong as they were anymore. I think a lot more people are going to Conservative now.
No. I still vote Labour, even so. But yeah. I agree with what other people are saying. I'm getting a bit more vague about it at the moment. But it's still be mostly Labour. I'll still vote the same.
As ever, James, you probably shouldn't read too much into that. But it's just a good counterpoint to the sort of overwhelming sort of narrative from you know, social media and actually some of the polls. And the polls have got the Tories and Labour neck and neck. Which, you know, some people might expect the Tories to be doing less well, given the fact we're in the middle of a pandemic. But I tell you what, let's move on. We'll turn our attention to the lockdown and what the Times Radio Focus Group panel think about the current lockdown and the rules. That's next here on Times Radio.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio.
Patricia Cornwell learnt to spacewalk for her latest novel Spin. We'll talk cybercrime, quantum physics and good old-fashioned forensics as well. We'll also ask why house prices have gone up so much and what the outlook is for 2021. How has the pandemic changed people's priorities when looking for somewhere to live? And in our obituary slot, Life and Times, Michael Rue Jr. will pay tribute to his father, the gastronomist extraordinaire, Albert Rue.
Mariella Frostrup, this afternoon from 1 on Times Radio. Matt Chorley. Mid-morning on Times Radio.
Yeah, it's the Times Radio Focus Group, where we speak to a panel of swing voters, half Tory, half Labour, from across the country. James Johnson carrying it out with Kext CNC for us. James, let's turn our attention to the lockdown now. And you asked them how they were finding this lockdown this time around.
I think it was needed.
Yeah, I agree. The cases were just skyrocketing. Needed to be done. Should have done it sooner.
Probably a good idea to make it obligatory for everybody. But what I can't see, with the exception of nurseries for people with young families. I've got five grandchildren, and three children with families, and I can't see what more they can do to us. Everyone keeps calling for a harder lockdown. Anyone got any ideas about where they could improve on what they're currently doing?
I don't think everything rests on just the government's shoulders, to be honest with you. I when I'm going about my daily business every day, there are a lot of people that are not following the rules.
I think I agree with you on that one. They can only do so much to the government unless people actually follow the rules.
Yeah. It's still the stress of just even going to the shops down the road. You don't know if you're going to get told off or...
I'm finding it hard because I think I'm used to it. But also it's very frustrating at the same time that when you just want to go meet a friend for a walk in the park, you've got to think, oh, like, is that worth the risk? Am I going to, like, is somebody going to misconstrue something? Like, you see videos all over the place at the minute.
Yeah, it's a fair bit of confusion, or at least saying they were confused about the rules. In fact, let's take a listen. You asked them exactly how clear you thought they thought the rules were.
No, they're asinine. There's loopholes in every law.
I think that we've heard so many rules now throughout the pandemic that no one actually knows what they are anymore, like, clearly.
Sorry, I just think there's been that many rules. Everyone kind of takes their own spin on them nowadays because no one... You make your rules and you know what you've got to do, but you see, even today, still multiple people walking around without face masks on, and even going into shops very close to each other. Obviously, they could be from the same family, but it's
Well, that was what the panel had to say about the rules. They're all a bit confused. So, James, the really interesting thing on this. And we had quite a long conversation. Justice Matt Hancock last night was announcing that he would not make any changes to support bubbles and to childcare bubbles. It turned out the group didn't really know what a bubble was. A lot of talk as well about this, the two women who were fined for being out walking with a coffee, although those fines have since been dropped. To what extent do you think people are confused by the rules, or they just don't like them and they're picking their own rules?
Oh, I think there's some genuine confusion in here. I think that basically the general sense that you sort of get from listening to the focus group is that individually people know about sort of 25% of the rules together, but it's only when they come together that actually you get the sense that they fully know them. I think that comes from the fact this isn't just a sort of a clean start. It's not like the first lockdown where the rules just come in and that's that. They've had to evolve over time. They've had to deal with the changing situation, as well as obviously previously rules being different in different places. There was some praise for gov.uk for being a sort of central database of the rules now, but they've also had to struggle with these difficult concepts. And, you know, support bubbles, things like support bubbles, you know, a lot of us sort of in the Westminster bubble and government sort of think, well, support bubbles, everybody knows what those are. Actually, people thought that meant the rule of six. People thought that was just another word for household. So really difficult in the sense of that, you know, if the government wants people to comply more, they need to make sure they're constantly getting across the message of what these rules actually are in the first place.
Yeah, to be clear, the Westminster bubble is completely separate. It is not something related to support bubbles or family bubbles or childcare bubbles or whatever it might be. There was concern about the police being heavy-handed, but I mean, obviously the message was getting through that the police were out and about and people having doubts about going out. So maybe the government would be would be happy with that. There was one exchange that I thought was really interesting about the impact that all this is having on us and the sort of the national mood, if you like, in this lockdown compared to the last one. Let's take a listen to a discussion that they had about how they were people possibly even judging each other.
I think it's just causing everybody to judge people when it's no one's business. But you have to, because you just don't know who's got it, who hasn't got it.
Okay.
I think that's the worst bit, is when people are judging people as well, because you don't know people's circumstances, you don't know who's in whose support bubble, you don't know who lives with who. So people are jumping to conclusions. And it's when we, at the beginning, I think it was all about togetherness and be kind, and now it's turned into a very, very me, very, very selfish world out there, I think.
It's interesting that, James, isn't it? That the impact that everyone sort of feels a bit more on their own, they're a bit more suspicious of people, they think other people are suspicious of them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's very different to what we saw earlier in the pandemic, where this sort of sense of national spirit. They didn't talk about it this time. I think it's the first time that the Dominic Cummings words have not come up in the focus group.
You're right. The Barnard Castle klaxon was not sounded. Yeah, that's a very good point.
Yeah, it's so we'll have to see whether that's a pattern or not in our future ones. But a lot of things over the last year, like celebrities breaking the rules, like the Dominic Cummings affair, and also just the length of the pandemic has meant that a lot of that national spirit has gone. And I think that that makes it harder for the government to sort of get people to comply, as the more sort of people get frustrated, the more they sort of put their hands up in the air and say, well, I'll take this risk, or I'll pop out and see that person. Now, that's not to say that compliance is poor. It's clearly quite good, and clearly the rules aren't as strict as the first lockdown, but certainly more of a challenge if you can't appeal to that sense of national spirit as they were able to do the first time round.
James, let's turn our attention now to the vaccine. Obviously, the rollout of the vaccine is the big question of the day. And you asked them how keen they'd be on having a vaccine at 2 a.m.
In the morning.
Yes.
In the morning.
No.
Well, yeah, because I think the situation is all hands on deck. So the faster we can do it, the better. So I would do it, but obviously a lot of people wouldn't. But yeah, it'll be fine with me.
Yeah, I'd do it.
Anyone else, Max?
Yeah, I'd definitely do it. I know it's late and stuff, but people can't moan that they're not rolling it out fast enough if people won't go and get it at a given time. So,
okay. I'd
do it obviously, because I'm a single parent, I can't exactly leave my child to go and get it. If it was a reasonable time, I want to get it either way. It just needs to be accessible for, or at least staggered throughout the days of and hours of the day when people can go and get it.
I wouldn't personally, but that's because of my personal circumstances. I think if that fits in with your lifestyle, then that fits in with your lifestyle. But I think it's unrealistic to ask the majority of people to do it.
I personally would have pushed the vaccinations, and if people were going to be a bit funny with the vaccinations, I'd have made it mandatory for certain ages.
So, James, really interesting there. We should point out again that this is not an opinion poll. It's just a focus group and the views of the seven or eight people on the group last night. But I think this is the first time we've done one of these where some form of vaccine scepticism or even anti-vaccine hasn't come up at all. They were all very keen on the vaccine and concerns about childcare if they had to go and get one at 2 o'clock in the morning. And actually going as far as one chap there going as far as suggesting that having the vaccine should be mandatory.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we've seen that in polls as well. I think the ONS released a poll showing that uptake has increased the more the vaccination programmes gone on. I mean, and they also feel like the vaccine rollout has gone pretty well so far. A lot of people are aware of that 2 million figure that we saw Boris Johnson announce yesterday, and generally a sense that it had sort of gone at an impressive pace. The interesting thing that I found about this, and perhaps challenged my own biases, I'm one of these people who's desperate for the government to go as fast as possible on this so we can have some freedom, is that there wasn't really this sort of much sense of impatience with the vaccine rollout either, or really much interest in it. There was just this sort of general perception that it was being handled well and it was going on at a sensible pace. So for these voters, it sort of felt like something that was going well, and they were just going to sit back and wait for it to be done.
Yeah, no, it was remarkable. And if you compare that to some of the views that we've picked up in the last few months, yeah, they do seem much more maybe resigned rather than happy, but just, resigned to the fact that this is where we are. We needed a lockdown because cases were rising. and we just have to sit tight and wait for the vaccine. Next up, this is really interesting. So you asked them two things. In a moment we'll hear when you asked when we'd be back to normal. But first, let's hear what they said when you asked them when this lockdown might end.
I think at least April.
Yeah, I'd quite agree with that time. April, Easter bank holiday. Just looking at the rates still going up.
It's quite hard to put a figure on it.
We'll come out of it when we get vaccinated.
It's probably looking like it's going to be a good few months.
So there we are. That was how they thought how long it might be until we're out of the lockdown. Now, the big question, which I've been asking you to send in today as well, when will we be back to normal?
At least next year, I'm thinking maybe October, but I'm fully everything better. I'm thinking maybe next year, but who knows? It changes every week.
I'd hope October, but the pessimist in me, I'm thinking we'll probably be around about Christmas time, possibly the new year. Because all it needs is one mutation and it throws everything out again.
I think it'll be next year. But I also think they need another winter of like people being vaccinated to find out what is going to go with the figures and the infection rate.
Well, it seems to be that potential. I think Chris Whitty alluded to this the other day at the briefing, that it could be a seasonal thing where going forward we'd have to have more precautions in winter. I hope not, but you know, it might be that we're like animals that hibernate in winter. Every winter we have to hibernate, and every summer we go out and play. I hope that's not the case, but who knows how long the virus is going to last for.
Back to normal, actually. I think it's going to be later on this year. Hopefully, maybe autumn, I would have thought. So maybe even summer if we're lucky.
James, before I get your take on those, Times Radio listeners have been sending in their predictions as well. It just goes to show nobody knows because they're all over the place. Neve says around mid-May the pubs will be open, indoor mixing allowed, but there'll still be some limits and it'll be a while before they'll be removed. Peter says 2024, blimey, before we get back to normal. Someone else saying spring 2022, May 2022. So then Ryan says pubs and restaurants open end of March, complete normality by the summer holidays. Jack says normalising back to how it was before well into next year, normalising things open and likely to close again autumn this year. And on it goes. What do you make of the level of sort of optimism that you'd normally expect listening into one of these focus groups, James Johnson?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's basically the public are quite grounded on this stuff. They don't have unrealistic expectations. They're not really listening to the government in terms of their targets or aims. There wasn't really a mention of when Boris Johnson has said to reopen. And obviously, Boris Johnson's sort of previous promises have got quite a lot of coverage in terms of, you know, be back to normal by Christmas or back to normal by spring, et cetera, et cetera. Those don't really seem to be cutting through. I think it goes back to that point, Matt, that the public are sort of quite resigned to this pandemic, and they know it's bad and they're trying to carry on their life as much as possible, and they know it's a bit of a waiting game and they're pretty realistic about that.
Yeah, I suppose that's the thing, is it the mood of instead of hanging on every word, watching every press conference, thinking, oh, next week we might be out of all this, people do seem much more realistic, perhaps. Finally, you asked them for their single message. If and I'm sure Boris Johnson's got Times Radio on when he's working from home this morning. You asked for their one message to the government.
Listen to the science.
Be clear on what your restrictions are.
Don't promise us anything that you can't fulfil.
More fact-checking on what you announce.
Make the rules more understandable so there's no loopholes and interpretations.
Do what you have to do and don't try to pander to the media all the time.
So, James, what to take away from that? If you were in Downing Street right now, as you did this job for Theresa May, what's the takeaway? What would you be putting in your notes to Boris Johnson about what he should be doing heading into 2021?
Yeah, well, I think I'd be saying, you know, that actually, for considering, you know, all that's happened over the last 12 months, this is clearly a relatively strong position for Boris Johnson, though we have seen in other focus groups and indeed in polls, in the Red Wall, for example, perhaps the damage to the brand is a little bit stronger there. Overall, this is a pretty good position for Boris Johnson. But there has been some sort of attrition to his brand, as I say, particularly on indecision, particularly on U-turns, particularly on the sort of speed of bringing in restrictions, and especially on this sort of general sense that they sometimes are not being as clear as they could be on the communication. So I'd say those are the things to improve on. But I have to say, Matt, that listening to this focus group, I'd be much more worried if I was in Keir Starmer's office right now, because it really does just bring across the sense that, yes, they're still 4 years out from a general election, but there is a lot of work to do in terms of introducing Keir Starmer to the electorate. And I think that this focus group clearly shows that that's got to be Labour's objective over the next few months if they want to break through this otherwise, this attack that's otherwise landing about Keir Starmer playing party politics.
Just finally then, James, legally, we always ask about Rishi Sunak. Well, here, I mean, what was interesting, actually, we asked about several other people. Gavin Williams, I mean, what was it, 90 minutes of material, so we obviously can't play it all out on air. Gavin Williamson, they weren't totally sure who he was, just generally thought the schools issue was a bit of a mess. Tony Blair, similarly, not that bothered. But time and time again, I think every time we've done one of these, going all the way back to June last year, one person always comes out of it very positively. Let's hear what they had to say when you asked them about Rishi Sunak.
I like him. I think he's doing a good job. I think he's trying to keep the country moving and keep the country going, as well as looking after people.
I'll be honest, I'd love to know where they're finding all the money from that they keep pulling out of fresh air, because for years all we've heard is the government scheme, but all of a sudden they've got millions and millions.
I like him. I'm getting this grant, this self-employed grant every 3 months.
Yeah, I think he's doing a good thing by being generous with this whole thing right from the start.
I think his kind of help and support is very helpful for everybody.
Yeah, I think he's done a good job, but I was just thinking, could you imagine how much he would have been criticised if he was a Labour Chancellor giving people money to stay at home? You'd never hear the end of it.
James, I thought that last comment was about the most politically astute bit of analysis from the whole group, actually.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, what we see here is that Rishi Sunak is still riding high. It's not, I mean, it's funny, right? Because a lot of that suggests that Rishi Sunak is only popular because he's given money out. But actually, when you dig a bit deeper, there is more to it than that. A lot of it goes back to that speech he gave when he sort of first announced the financial support. People just instinctively like him. They feel like he's more on their side. And I think that the interesting thing here is that could well continue, even if he has to make tough financial decisions, because you heard in there is this sense that the debt is very high. There is this permission for the government to make difficult decisions, as long as it's seen as fair, as long as it's seen like they're paying in, but also the more richer people are as well. But yeah, if you're really listening to this, then nothing's changed over the last 6 months. You're still the most popular person, well, really, in UK politics.
Well, we've come to the end of this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. Listen to my Times Radio show every Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. You can listen on DAB Radio on your smart speaker. Get the Times Radio app. You can also listen to the Red Box Podcast of the Times Radio app as well. And if you want to read about the stories that we've been talking about, then you need a Times subscription to get that. Go to times.radio/subscribe.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.